Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States says it will protect its interests in Syria while keeping lines of communication with Russia open. Washington was reacting to Moscow's warning against aircraft operating in its area of operation after a U.S. warplane Sunday shot down a Syrian aircraft the U.S. said was dropping bombs near U.S.-backed rebel forces. Sean Spicer is a White House spokesman.
The escalation of hostilities among the many factions that are operating in this region doesn't help anybody. And the Syrian regime and others in the regime need to understand that we will retain the right of self-defense of coalition forces aligned against ISIS.
Russia, which backs Syria, said it would treat U.S.-led coalition aircraft flying west of the Euphrates River as potential targets. It did not say it would shoot them down. General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, said an eight-month-old deconfliction link between the two militaries is still active.
That link is still ongoing here this morning. When I left the building this morning, we've still been communicating over the last few hours. I, like you, saw in the open source some reporting from Moscow, which I won't address right now. I would just tell you that we'll work diplomatically and militarily in the coming hours to reestablish deconfliction. The Russian Federation has indicated that their purpose in Syria, like ours, is to defeat ISIS, and we'll see if that's true here in the coming hours.
Adding to tensions, Iran Sunday fired missiles at suspected Islamic State targets in eastern Syria. The government of Central African Republic has signed a peace agreement in Rome with all but one of the armed groups operating the country, aimed at ending 4 years of conflict that's left thousands dead. Among the other things, the deal, mediated by a Roman Catholic peace group, calls for an internationally monitored ceasefire, giving armed groups representation at all levels, and are part of reconstruction efforts. This is VOA News. The family of Otto Warmbier, the American college student who was detained in North Korea for 18 months, announced he died Monday after being returned last week to the U.S. in a coma. Doctors said the 22-year-old suffered severe brain damage while in detention. President Donald Trump offered his condolences.
He spent a year and a half in North Korea. A lot of bad things happened. But at least we got him home to be with his parents, where they were so happy to see him, even though he was in very tough condition. But he just passed away a little while ago. It's a brutal regime, and we'll be able to handle it.
Pyongyang said Warmbier fell into a coma after he was sentenced in March last year for stealing a political poster from a North Korean hotel. The regime claimed he was given a sleeping pill after contracting botulism. The family insists he had been terrorized and brutalized. British Prime Minister Theresa May visited London's Finsbury Park Mosque, meeting with members of the community as it recovers from an attack hours earlier by a white suspect who used a van to plow through Muslim worshippers. At least nine were injured.
The terrible terrorist attack that took place last night was an evil act born out of hatred, and it has devastated a community. I'm pleased to have been here today to see the strength of that community coming together, all faiths, united in one desire to see extremism and hatred of all sorts driven out of our society.
The suspect is identified by media as 47-year-old Darren Osborne, a Welsh father of four, reported to have shouted, "I want to kill Muslims." He's being held on suspicion of preparing or instigating terrorism, including murder and attempted murder. The number of those deceased, missing, or presumed dead from last week's high-rise apartment building fire in London has risen to at least 79. Britain held a moment of silence Monday for the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire. Stuart Cundy is a Metropolitan Police commander.
This is an incredibly distressing time for families, and they have my commitment that we will do this as quickly as we possibly can. The awful reality, as I've said before, is that due to the intensity of the fire and the devastation within Grenfell Tower, that we may not be able to identify everybody that died.
Only five bodies have been positively identified. A driver known to French security forces rammed his car full of weapons into a police van in Paris. He died in the incident. The cause, not immediately known. There were no other casualties. A handful of survivors said nearly 130 migrants drowned off Libya's coast last week after their rubber dinghy foundered when smugglers removed the engine. The incident occurred Thursday as the overloaded vessel attempted the treacherous crossing to Europe. A passing Libyan vessel saved the survivors, identified as two Sudanese and two Nigerians. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is World Refugee Day, and we'll examine the plight of South Sudan refugees in Uganda.
This deal takes note of the interests of people in the Bangui Forum of 2015, where the citizens of Central African Republic made clear they want to see criminal justice.
We'll also examine the plight of West Africa refugees. Former African Union Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma agrees to contest the presidency of the African National Congress, and Central African Republic warring parties sign a new peace deal.
This deal takes note of the interests of people in the Bangui Forum of 2015, where the citizens of Central African Republic made clear they want to see criminal justice.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Lake Tanganyika, the world's longest, is dubbed a threatened lake. And a new drug that acts like a vaccine helps to lower bad cholesterol. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today is World Refugee Day, and this week, Uganda welcomes UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and other high-level international guests and donors for a two-day refugee solidarity conference beginning this Thursday. As Halima Adumani reports, the conference, which will be held in Kampala, hopes to raise $8 billion to support South Sudan refugees in Uganda.
At the border, separating Uganda from South Sudan, exhausted women and children arrive daily, hungry and dehydrated. Aid workers give them fortified biscuits. Uganda hosts 1.2 million refugees from at least five African countries. Nearly 1 million have fled the conflict in South Sudan, and most have arrived in the past year. The local food supply is stretched to the limit. The UN World Food Programme was forced to cut food rations to refugees last month, says WFP country representative Elkidir Dalum.
Yes, we have been forced to reduce the distribution for the month of May 50%, but that is mainly due to the physical availability of food and the arrival of food in country.
Funding is also inadequate. The United Nations and 57 other aid organizations working in northern Uganda appealed for $1.4 billion to provide food and shelter this year, but only 18% of the funds has been received. Amnesty International researchers visited the refugee settlements in Uganda, and Deputy Regional Director Michelle Kagari says the refugees have already suffered greatly.
There's one woman who has 9 children. Her and her children witnessed their father being killed, not to mention the trauma of fleeing the Equatorias. When they arrive in Uganda, because there's no capacity for them to get additional support, she's now supposed to build a shelter herself, find food for the children, deal with the trauma of the children.
Uganda is known for its progressive approach to refugees. There are no refugee camps, but settlements where refugees build round mud huts and get small plots of land to farm. They are also allowed to work in Uganda. But the massive influx from South Sudan, as many as 2,000 people a day during the past year, is taking a toll on the host communities. Uganda is hosting this week's Refugee Solidarity Summit in an urgent plea for help, says Uganda's State Minister for Refugees, Musa Echeru.
A district that was supposed to host 300,000 people is now hosting 600,000, 700,000 people. That district, they are competing for trees that are used as fuel for energy. They are competing for drugs that are supposed to be used by the host communities in the health centers. So there are so many things that are under pressure. So we want the international community to support us, lift the pressure.
Food security is a particular concern, given the hunger and famine in South Sudan and drought in East Africa. At the Maju refugee settlement, 25-year-old Jennifer Fone is 8 months pregnant and struggling to have 2 meals a day.
As you can see, children are crying here because of hunger. We are not getting anything to buy to our children food. As I have three children, but food is not enough for us. We are just eating those green vegetables, but no any proteins.
Back at the border, the scene is the same. More families arrive, sweating in the scorching heat, carrying their belongings. The government says Uganda will not shut its doors to people in need, but the country cannot bear this burden alone. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Adjumani, Uganda.
Officials at the United Nations Refugee Agency want to use today, World Refugee Day, to draw attention to the plight of refugees everywhere. In West Africa, important issues include statelessness and Nigerian refugees returning to their homes where services are not up to standard to receive them. UNHCR West Africa Regional Representative Liz Agua spoke to Ricky Stryak about these challenges.
So a variety of factors had led to the situation where we had in West Africa that huge number of people at risk of statelessness. So from 2015 to today, 2017, we have had to establish, with the help of all the 15 governments, focal points in each of the countries selected and designated by the responsible ministries to work with UNHCR in a targeted manner to draw up national plans for preventing and ending statelessness. The plan, which has been called the Banjul Plan of Action, has since the last month, when we concluded the meeting in the conference in Banjul, been presented to the states, the chiefs, the heads of states of ECOWAS. They have endorsed the regional plan. So basically, this is a plan that has now, let's say, legal backing behind it for us to work towards eradicating and preventing statelessness by the year 2024.
Inside Niger, UNHCR has recently opened an office in Agadez. It's near the transit routes for migrants who are going to Libya and then taking a boat to Europe. According to UNHCR, this office is aimed at providing refugees swift access to asylum. What is the current state of that Niger route for migrants on their way to Libya, and how much success have you guys seen in terms of helping refugees gain access to asylum in this region?
UNHCR has opened that office because, working together with IOM, it was estimated that there were between 1 to 5% refugees found is mixed among migrants looking towards going to Europe. The second premise of our opening an office there was because the flow of migrants in our situation, mixed migrants, once they get to Europe, it has been discovered that up to 30 to 31% of them were being given asylum in Europe on humanitarian basis. So we're working together with the government to be able to find our footprint or find a niche to work, prevent, or at least to reduce asylum seekers being exposed to horrible circumstances before they get asylum.
As some Nigerian refugees return home in the northeast of the country, what challenges are they facing?
The refugees, and just in the month of May, over 12,000 refugees crossed over. When they come back, they are coming back to IDP camps. The IDP camps already are full, and so when you have 10,000 more people coming back, there is a huge stress on all the assistance. There is pressure on all the assistance that is being given.
That was Liz Ahua, UNHCR's West Africa Regional Representative. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 20th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Rebel groups in the Central African Republic on Monday signed a peace deal with the government to end a civil war that began in 2013 when President Francois Bozize was overthrown by a Muslim-majority group called the Seleka. Christians, who make up 80% of the population, formed a militia group called Anti-Balaka. The new agreement calls for immediate ceasefire. It will also give armed groups representation in the government and into the country's armed forces. Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. She says the agreement also takes into consideration the wishes of the people of Central African Republic for accountability for atrocities committed and also the setting up of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
This deal takes note of the interests of people in the Bangui Forum of 2015, where the citizens of Central African Republic made clear they want to see criminal justice for those atrocities and to break long-standing impunity in the country. The agreement also takes note of the International Criminal Court's investigation in Central African Republic, which is ongoing, and the work of the Special Criminal Court, which is a unique and important new court that's being set up in Central African Republic to try and bring some justice for past crimes. The agreement also provides for the setting up of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would have a 12-month mandate and make recommendations on truth-telling and transitional justice.
So, Elise, the signatories all commit themselves to a nationwide ceasefire. Given the history of the Central African Republic and the violence there, how likely is it that this agreement will hold?
You know, I think that's a very important question, James. I think no one can foretell the future on that one, and certainly many agreements have been broken in the past. It certainly brings some hope that this could contribute to an end to the violence, which has persisted in the country, with much of the country currently unstable and insecure. So certainly, if it were able to do that, that would be a huge benefit for the people of Central African Republic. And that kind of ceasefire combined with efforts and accountability and a whole range of other measures at disarmament, reintegration would be very important for the people of Central African Republic.
I was speaking to someone in Angola yesterday about a bill that is being pushed through the parliament, essentially giving the president of Angola, Dos Santos, immunity. So people say for Central African Republic, the first place to start is some stability before we talk about justice. What do you say?
This is an argument that rears its ugly head many times during efforts to deal with conflict. And I think it's important to see that the experience is much more that lack of justice fuels further violence, whereas accountability really contributes to building respect for the rule of law and long-term sustainable peace. So from our perspective, it is essential that both be pursued in parallel at negotiations to end conflict or provide security measures, while also that trials are pursued. And that is really the best way to ensure a brighter future for the population. It's also relevant that the world has really come together and come to the agreement, so to speak, under international law, that immunity or amnesty for the gravest crimes, genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, is inconsistent with that law. It's inconsistent with the obligations for the importance of the opportunity for victims to have access to redress.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from New York City. Former African Union Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma has reportedly agreed to contest the presidency of South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party. She reportedly accepted the nomination at an ANC Youth League event in the town of Limpopo. The ANC election will take place at the end of this year. If elected, Dlamini-Zuma will be the first female to head the party, but she will have to defeat other prominent candidates, including current Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, South Africa's Speaker of the National Assembly, Baleka Mbete, and Lindiwe Sisulu, current Minister of Human Settlement. Political analyst Karima Brown says Dlamini-Zuma may not be the candidate to unify a divided ANC because she is so firmly entrenched in the ANC faction that is tied to her former husband, President Jacob Zuma.
I think that it's important to recognize that Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is a leader of the African National Congress in her own right. She has a political profile that is very separate from her former husband. President Jacob Zuma has, in fact, anointed her as his successor and has in fact publicly spoken out and said that he believes he's the best person to succeed him. And he did that in violation of the organization's own rules regarding how to deal with nominations and with presidential succession races. The problem for Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is that she is so firmly entrenched in the faction that is tied and centering around her husband. And because of that, she is not going to be a candidate that will be able to unite the African National Congress. In the over 100 years of the organization, it has never been this divided. It's in fact went down the middle. And Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is not a candidate that is going to engender unity. She is too firmly entrenched in the faction associated with her former husband. So I think it's going to be very hard to sell her as somebody that can unite the organization.
I was reading, Ms. Brown, that the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference has told the ANC to choose the next president as somebody who can stand up to President Jacob Zuma. As you know, that President Zuma is facing all kinds of allegations of corruption. Do you think that Dlamini Zuma can be able to stand up in case she's the next president of the ANC?
No, it's going to be very difficult. As I said, her main backers are people who have largely benefited off the administration of President Jacob Zuma, particularly people in provinces, the provincial premiers, particularly in the Free State, in Mpumalanga, in the Northwest. Those are people who are very closely associated with the Zuma administration and have in fact been exposed as people linked to this massive attempt to capture the state for private financial gain. And Dlamini Zuma has been associated with that project. She's come to its aid and its defense. And as I said, President Jacob Zuma has put his stamp of approval on her as the person to succeed. She's not going to be able to recalibrate the ANC. And certainly, in my view, she won't be able to close the gap that has opened between the ANC and its traditional support base.
So who are the other candidates? Is the deputy president of South Africa also in the running?
At this stage, the two kind of front runners seem to be Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and the deputy president Cyril Ramaphosa. But there are others that have put up their hands. There is Lindiwe Sisulu, who is, of course, the current Minister for Human Settlements. She doesn't come from a politically insignificant family. The Sisulus have played a huge role in the African National Congress. So the idea of a female president isn't confined to Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. There are other senior African National Congress women leaders who are stating their claim, and Lindiwe Sisulu is definitely one of them. The other female that has definitely put up a hand is Baleka Mbete. She's currently the national speaker in our parliament, and she's also the chairperson of the governing party. So even if one is talking about a female candidate, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma isn't necessarily the only candidate.
That's political analyst Karima Brown speaking with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Lake Tanganyika, the second largest lake in Africa, which touches four countries, has been named the Threatened Lake of 2017 by Global Nature Fund. As Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura, the group says sedimentation, pollution, and over-exploitation are jeopardizing the lake.
Lake Tanganyika, world's longest lake, is shared by Burundi, Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania and Zambia. The lake remains the source of income to more than 10 million people living around the shores. Rising population, pollution and over-exploitation are a major threat to the lake, according to the Global Nature Fund, a non-profit foundation aimed at protecting the environment. Ndayishimiye Ejid is a fisherman in Bujumbura.
The water is polluted. Sometimes those industrials lease water that contains acid. This kills the fish and even affects us, like our feet get burned because of the chemicals powered the lake.
100,000 people are directly involved in the fisheries operating from almost 800 sites. Many, like Ndayishimiye, depend on the lake for a living, but now there has been a remarkable decrease of fish in the lake. Leonie Zeimana is the Director of Water and Aquaculture at the Burundi Ministry of Agriculture.
Normally, we don't export a lot because of the low production, but still, the production is not enough for Burundians themselves. There is a problem pollution in the Bujumbura side because of the increase in the population.
The Lake Basin faces multiple challenges resulting from the activities of rapidly expanding human populations in the riparian countries. Between 1995 to 2011, the total fish stock has decreased by 25%, while the number of fishermen increased 4 times. Emmanuel Dorimana, the Director General of Water in Burundi Ministry of Environment, says that the government is trying to control the pollution in the lake through sensitizing the citizens.
The solid waste from the town, from Bujumbura town, from Rumonge town, from Nyanzarake town, so destination is Lake Tanganyika because they are not well managed in the town.
Industrial, craft and domestic waste from the cities and villages along lake are directly discharged into the lake without any pretreatment. The threat still remains as natural habitats around the lake are distracted by the expansion of land used for agriculture or construction. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Lake Tanganyika.
A drug that acts like a vaccine has been shown to lower cholesterol and reduce the amount of fatty plaques that can lead to heart attacks. The drug rallies the immune system against a molecule that contributes to atherosclerosis, viewer Jessica Berman reports.
Currently, many people at risk for heart attack take medication that drives down so-called bad cholesterol known as LDL cholesterol. Oliver Siegel with the Austrian pharmaceutical company Afurus says the so-called statin drugs do not work for everyone.
What field studies have shown is that patients who already had a heart attack have a relatively low adherence or compliance rate, and we would imagine that patients who didn't have a heart attack yet would have an even lower compliance rate.
That's where a vaccine-like compound, generically known as AT04A, comes in. It is a form of immunotherapy that targets an enzyme called PCSK9 that contributes to the formation of harmful plaque in coronary arteries. Fatty plaques that develop in the heart vessels can choke off the flow of blood, causing a heart attack, or break off, causing a stroke in the brain. Heart disease is a leading cause of illness and death worldwide. In studies of mice fed fatty Western-style diets, putting them at risk for heart disease, researchers showed AT04A reduced the total amount of cholesterol by 53% and shrank atherosclerotic plaques by 64%, according to Siegel.
And more importantly, in those mice, we have seen a very significant reduction in development of those plaques. And as a result, we believe that the reduction of LDL, which we had seen before, would translate into a clinical benefit, i.e. reduction of plaque that would otherwise produce an inflammation that would otherwise be the cause of a heart attack, potentially.
The findings were published in European Heart Journal. AT04A rallied the immune system to produce antibodies that block the PCSK9 enzyme in the blood circulation of mice during the study. The immunotherapeutic approach, according to Siegel, is similar to, but not a vaccine in the sense that it does not target bacteria and viruses, just the harmful enzyme. Siegel says the shot under the skin would have to be given once a year like an immunization. Early human clinical trials testing the compound's safety are nearly complete, and Siegel hopes to have a cholesterol-lowering, clot-busting drug on the market in the next few years. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very nice day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa.
a preview of the Kenyan presidential election. The race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga, the main opposition candidate, is looking increasingly competitive. A discussion on Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.